and welcome to Generation Justice. We are broadcasting from the University of New Mexico, KUNM 89.9 FM, news and music that connect. I'm Lucia Martinez.
And I'm Jason Fuller. Generation Justice is a multimedia project aimed at youth to create media that is committed to social change.
In this day and age, rarely do individuals experience success without the help of others. As Isaac Newton said, we stand on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah, and because of that, this week's show is dedicated to mentors and role models and their impact on the lives of young people.
We are featuring three interviews conducted by my co-host, Jason Fuller. First, we will hear from Sharon Tenorio and Denise Nava from Big Brothers and Big Sisters of America. Then, Mark Worthy, a local mentor, helps us to understand the concept of paying it forward. Finally, for a national view, we will hear from renowned journalist Russ Mitchell on how role models made a difference in his life and career.
But before that, here's Children's Work by Dessa.
You didn't say too much, but smile taught me how to quiet down my mind. I learned how to paint my face, how to earn my keep, how to clean my kill. Some nights I still can't sleep. The past goes back, I can see us still. You learned how to hold your own, how to stack your stones, but the history's thick. Children aren't as simple as we'd like to think.
Big Brothers and Big Sisters of America is an organization dedicated to helping young people realize their potential. They have provided mentorship opportunities for children ages 6 through 18 throughout the country for over 100 years.
Members of Big Brothers and Big Sisters of America impact the lives of children, but as you will hear, children also impact the lives of their mentors.
Yeah, Jason. This reciprocal relationship improves outcomes and creates opportunities. Jason will interview Sharon Tenorio, the Chief of Marketing for Big Brothers and Big Sisters in Central New Mexico, and Denise Nava, one of the organization's Big Sisters.
Good afternoon. My name is Jason Fuller with Generation Justice, and we're here with Denise Nava from the Albuquerque Community Foundation, who serves as a mentor through Big Brothers and Big Sisters of America, as well as Sharon Tenorio through Big Brothers and Big Sisters of America. Thank you all for taking time out today to talk with us here at Generation Justice.
Sure, of course.
Thank you.
I guess we'll start with you, Sharon. What got you involved into Big Brothers and Big Sisters, and just your background?
Okay. I am a native Albuquerquean. I grew up in the southeast side of Albuquerque, and I went to three schools that most Albuquerqueans know as not the best schools: Emerson Elementary, Van Buren Middle School, and Highland High School. And growing up, I was a typical kid that was at risk of dropping out of high school. But there were people along my path that helped mentor me and guide me and get me to a position where I could be the chief of marketing for a big organization like Big Brothers Big Sisters. Big Brothers Big Sisters serves over 1,500 kids in Central New Mexico. Nationwide, we serve about 1 million kids. And wow. we pair them in one-to-one mentoring relationships that change their lives for the better forever. And we serve kids that are ages 6 to 18.
Okay.
So we match them with adult mentors in a one-to-one relationship.
And Denise, could you introduce yourself to our Generation Justice family?
Sure. I'm Denise, and I'm from, born and raised in Silver City, New Mexico. I'm currently a graduate student at UNM studying public administration, and I'm graduating in May, which is really exciting.
Congratulations.
Thanks. Thank you. I also work here at the foundation, and I've been matched with my little for almost three years. It'll be 3 years in August, and her name is Jasmine.
Nice.
And she'll be 16 next month. Hmm. Yes.
So, Denise, you are a relatively young person.
I am.
but yet you're at the stage where you're already giving back. So I guess my first question is, why did you decide to be a mentor?
Well, growing up, my brother is 11 years older than me.
Okay.
So I was, I believe, in second grade when he left to go to college. So I kind of grew up an only child. And I think at the moment after I graduated college, I decided that it was something that I really wanted to do is have an influence and give the knowledge that I had at that time to somebody that didn't necessarily have a mentor in their life.
Who served as a mentor for you in order for you to realize what the commitment was to actually be a mentor?
When I was in high school, I was a part of different groups, and I was also on the high school dance team. So a lot of the older girls on the team kind of served as mentors, but I'd say the most influential person in my life is probably my mother. I know that she's already a born and raised mentor, considering she's my mother. But I don't know. She's a very giving person. She's a teacher. So I'm sure that can attribute to her giving nature. And I'd say she'd probably be the person that made me want to do something more rather than, you know, just go to college, get a job, and then live your life, I guess.
This next question that I have is actually for both you, Sharon, as well as you, Denise. And it's, what is the definition of a mentor?
For me, the definition of a mentor is someone who has more life experience than you, who takes you under their wing and shows you the way. That person is also a sounding board, right? It is someone who, when you're kind of at a crossroads or you're not sure that your gut is leading you in the right direction, that you're able to talk it out through them, and they're able to tell you, okay, have you thought this through or that through, and how would that work? That's how I describe a mentor. And it's not only within, you know, adults to children, but within your own work environments, within your own life.
In some way, I believe a mentor is somebody that makes you feel confident in what you're doing in life. And also, I agree with Sharon about a sounding board. With Jasmine, when we first met, she was really quiet and shy. And I feel like after our relationship grew, she was much more confident in speaking about how she felt, about what she wanted, about the things she noticed about life and situations that were happening to her. So I feel like as myself, as a mentor, by allowing her to talk openly, that she has gained confidence and comfortability in the person that she is.
Denise, could you actually talk more about this mentee and mentor relationship that you have with your little sister, Jasmine?
So we met when she was in middle school, and she was, like I said, she was really quiet. And at that time, she was having difficulties with relationships in her life. She's extremely caring and giving person, and I don't necessarily know if she had the ability to show those characteristics about herself at the beginning, but now she's much more willing to talk and participate in stuff that she wouldn't normally do. But our relationship's really strong. And it took some time. So I guess on the question of our relationship, it takes quite time for somebody to open up, for her to open up to me. I feel much more confident as well from our relationship.
Again, this question is for both of you. Why is it significant that young people have mentors who look like them?
I think it's significant because if they've never seen anyone who looked like them be accomplished, they don't know that they can do it themselves, but they also don't know that there are other people like them that are doing it themselves too. And what happens is you think that you are the person who is groundbreaking, and you realize that there were a lot of people that made it easier for you to be able to do this. I think that there's also this groupthink that happens, that if you've never seen anyone from your neighborhood or from that is of your ethnicity that has ever gone out into the world, you don't realize that it can be done, and you stay within your own little boundaries. For us, our biggest challenge, at least recruiting in New Mexico, is finding enough male Hispanic volunteers to match with the Hispanic kids. And when I look at who our clients are the children we serve about 55% of the kids we serve are Hispanic, where only 35% of our volunteers are Hispanic. That to me really is sad because, again, if you've never seen a Hispanic woman who heads a company, then you don't know that there's something different out there for you. So what I would like to see is more women and men of color, and especially men of color, step up and say, you know what, I can spend that hour a week with someone who's not my nephew or my grandson, but someone outside in our community.
Denise?
I think it kind of goes back to that whole confidence factor. Being with somebody of the same race and color as you are kind of gives you that familiarity and that confidence that you're not alone, like what Sharon had said.
I completely understand that feeling in terms of like the confidence and familiarity, because I almost view it as almost like an unspoken code or unspoken language. Again, when I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, majority of the political figures, individuals who were the principals of the schools to the mayor of the city, they all looked like me. So when I was growing up, I didn't feel as though I couldn't accomplish anything. So again, just having the symbol or an image and being able to relate to it, it does wonders because you don't feel like there are any limitations there that really stop you.
I think if you feel like you can make a difference in somebody's life, then you should definitely consider spreading your knowledge and values to somebody.
And I would say that being a mentor, being a big brother or a big sister really sounds like it's hard work. The reality is that you form a friendship with the child, with the family of the child. It's not work. You know, it becomes just a part of your life. It is not work to go out and play basketball with your friend or to invite them over to watch the football game with you. It becomes just a part of who you are and a part of your life. And you experience that joy just as much as the child that you're mentoring or the college student that you're mentoring. It's not hard work, but it's very valuable.
Denise, Sharon, it's been a pleasure talking with both of you. On the topic that I think at times can be overlooked, definitely has its value. And I think that it's just important for young people to know that rarely does anyone accomplish anything by themselves. So it's always good to have that guidance. It's always good to have those words of encouragement and criticism, because from that, you're able to grow, and mentors definitely do so. So do you guys have anything that you would like to add, any closing remarks?
Become a big brother, become a big sister, make an impact on a child's life, change their life for the better forever.
Big brothers, big sisters is an extremely rewarding experience, and I'm so grateful to have Jasmine in my life.
Denise, Sharon, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Jason.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you, guys. This is Jason Fuller with Generation Justice signing out.
That was Jason Fuller interviewing Sharon Tenorio and Denise Nava of Big Brothers and Big Sisters of America from the Central New Mexico office. Sharon and Denise, thank you for investing in the lives of young New Mexicans, especially young people of color. That was an engaging interview, Jason.
I feel that since Denise and Sharon both had mentors growing up, that each understood the importance of giving back. If you would like to get involved with Big Brothers and Big Sisters of America, visit their website, www.bbbs.org.
Before our next interview with Mark Worthy, we will hear Lean On Me by Bill Withers.
You just call on me, brother, when you need a hand. We all need somebody to lean on. I just might have a problem that you'll understand. We all need somebody.
You're listening to Generation Justice on KUNM 89.9 FM. And tonight, we're talking about mentors and role models of color.
Jason Fuller of Generation Justice had an intimate conversation with his own mentor, Mark Worthy, about the meaning of mentorship, its rewards, and the value of investing in young people.
Mr. Worthy is an international educator and currently teaches at Monterrey Tech in Monterrey, Mexico, and has served as my mentor for several years.
And now, here's Jason with Mark Worthy, addressing mentorship and paying it forward.
Good afternoon. My name is Jason Fuller here with Generation Justice, and we are here with Mr. Mark Worthy. How are you doing this afternoon?
Very well, Jason. Thank you so much for having me.
The pleasure is all mine. So, Mr. Worthy, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, your history, that would include academics, professional world, and so forth?
Jason, I was born and raised in Washington, D.C. Essentially, I am a baby boom child, and my formative period took place in the 60s. And by that I mean the decade. I can recall coming to a level of consciousness with my outer world at the time of the election of John F. Kennedy. And I was able to mature and gain insight into the world around me. Additionally, my parents were very active and involved with my education upbringing. They, as a matter of fact, met in college. So we had an opportunity to engage the world a certain way. My dad was active with the space program in the 60s. He was an aeronautical engineer. And he contributed to the Gemini and the Apollo programs. My mother, by training, is an academic. As a matter of fact, I'm a fourth generation educator. I spent my formative years engaged in private education, parochial Catholic education, and I conducted my undergraduate education at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. I had a desire since a child to engage in the world, perhaps as a result of my father engaging members of his cohort as they worked toward placing man on the moon. So many of the people that we visited or who visited our homes were from abroad. So I did not find myself limited to Washington, D.C., the East Coast of the United States. I had a clear understanding that I participated, I belonged to this world, and I had a desire to visit. So my courses of study enabled me to pursue language training, also understanding of global affairs, international economics, and this enabled me to move on in my career path to live and work abroad.
Excellent. And Mr. Worthy, you serve as a mentor to me and have mentored me since 2010, 2011, and I've definitely benefited from such. But my question for you is, why do you feel that mentorship is a necessity?
I believe that it is a necessity because there's so much that one must consider and entertain, especially our young students, our young people who are navigating a rapidly changing society. For instance, many students come to the University of New Mexico from other parts of the country, from abroad. And I do believe that it's very important for students to have some guidance, some assistance, some clarification with regard to that which is necessary to navigate the process and to do so successfully.
Mr. Worthy, I'm not sure if you've actually counted the years in which you've served as a mentor, but based on your expertise, I'll say that you are a rather great, rather exceptional mentor. So what is the definition of a mentor?
I believe that a mentor is someone who is willing to provide time, guidance, direction in order to help a person, a young person, male, female, who is in need of assistance, who has in possession attributes, skills that can be refined, honed, so that that person can move forward and realize his or her aspirations.
Okay, and what does the mentor and mentee relationship look like?
There is an ideal model. There's a complementary relationship. However, that is a fixed ideal. we are individuals. And as such, there needs to be a complement. There needs to be a coincidence of ideas between the mentor and the mentee. There needs to be mutual goal setting. There needs to be a desire to take a journey together. I believe for myself, a mentor has to be able to step back, give the mentee space to grow, and sometimes even make mistakes. Moreover, I do believe that it is important for the mentee to understand that trust is foundational, and the mentee needs to be able to know that he or she can engage a mentor and be willing to accept that insight, that direction that the mentor is providing unreservedly and with concern for well-being.
So why are you so committed? And then to another extent, why is it important that young people of color find other people of color as mentors?
Young people of color have a difficult time because too frequently there are too few to provide that support. You look at a campus such as ours or other campuses across the country, the representation, particularly in administration and faculty, is limited with regard to its diversity. Those who are in a position to assist, I believe, do as much as they possibly can. However, when you have faculty and administrators who are responsible for maintaining a structure of an administration, an institution of higher learning, a faculty member who is responsible for delivery of courses, they can only be spread so thinly. So everyone contributes the best way possible.
You just stated how on university campuses that the ratio for faculty of color to student of color ratio is disproportionate. What about outside of academia? There still seems to be a disparity between young people of color and other mentors of color.
I think that has to do a great deal with mobility, social mobility, economic mobility, political mobility. And this is something that needs to be examined further. We look at various states. We consider a state like California with 40 million people versus a state like New Mexico with 2 million people. There are 50,000 people in the state of New Mexico who self-identify as African American. 50,000 people? That's a neighborhood in Washington, D.C. So we always have to be careful with our analysis. We always have to consider the variables. We always have to consider the numbers. It's metricized. The larger block of people you have of a particular subculture, they can assist a greater number of beneficiaries.
Okay. Well, Mr. Worthy,
what's the reward for reinvesting in the next generation of young people?
It makes me think of a passage from A Raisin in the Sun. And there's an element of irony here because it was when Lena, younger, was a bit saddened by her children. But there's a line in which she says, "You are supposed to be my harvest. You are supposed to be my beginning again." And I've always felt those words profoundly. And I try to engage my mentees, not in a manner of trying to be an obsessive parent or surrogate, but to see value in a young person and to be able to assist that young person grow and move forward. And if I can accomplish that, as far as I'm concerned, I've done my job.
What is your word of encouragement in terms of encouraging them to serve as mentors for either peers who may be a few years younger than them or the next generation of young people?
I do believe it's extremely important for those future mentors to consider how they've grown, what they've been able to accomplish, and how one does not operate in a vacuum, because no matter what one may have accomplished, no matter how great, someone helped you get there. And that should never be forgotten. I want to thank you very much, Jason, for giving me this opportunity to articulate my thoughts. Rarely have I been questioned with regard to my philosophies and opinions regarding mentoring, because for me, it's second nature to me. I just do it. And I do it because I hope to contribute, and I also derive satisfaction by seeing someone move forward and becoming the person that he or she desires to become.
We just heard from Jason Fuller, speaking with his mentor, Mark Worthy, about the value of investing in young people of color. Thank you both for your insight and for sharing with us a little about how a mentor-mentee relationship works.
It was refreshing talking to my own mentor about mentorship. The knowledge that Mr. Worthy passed down to me has been immeasurable. Mr. Worthy actually pushed me to apply for the fellowship that I have currently with Generation Justice. I want to thank him, because now I serve as a role model and mentor to other young people.
Thank you, Jason, for sharing your story. Up next, we have more music. You'll hear When You Believe by Whitney Houston and Mariah Carey. Afterwards, an interview with journalist Russ Mitchell.
It's hard to kill. Who knows what miracle you can achieve when you believe? Somehow you will.
Our next guest is Russ Mitchell. Mr. Mitchell worked as a reporter and anchor at CBS for 20 years, and is now an anchor and managing editor at WKYC-TV in Cleveland, Ohio.
He will share his story about how he became a successful African-American journalist and will provide career advice for young professionals.
Here is Jason speaking with Russ Mitchell.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jason Fuller with Generation Justice, and we have the honor of speaking with Mr. Russ Mitchell. Mr. Mitchell, how are you doing this afternoon?
Jason, I'm great. How are you?
I am doing well. It's great to hear your voice.
It's good talking to you again. Thanks for giving me a shout.
Mr. Mitchell, could you please introduce yourself to our Generation Justice family?
Sure. My name is Russ Mitchell. I'm an anchor and managing editor at WKYC-TV in Cleveland, Ohio. Before that, I was at CBS News for 20 years, so maybe some folks know me from there. Been in Cleveland for about the last 2.5 years.
And could you explain to our listeners, I guess, your biggest change from working at CBS versus working in Cleveland?
Well, it's local TV, so I'm back in local television. I'm the anchor of our local newscast. It's 6 and 11. Of course, at CBS, I was an anchor and correspondent, so traveling all over the country doing stories. But the last 2.5 years, I've been here in Cleveland, anchoring again the 6 and 11, and, you know, covering stories. We've had some pretty big stories here in the last couple of years, so it's been challenging. It's been fun. Before I went to CBS, rather, I worked in local TV and always knew I wanted to go back at some point. And the time just seemed right 2.5 years ago, and I'm glad I made the move. It's been a good one.
Working at CBS for 20 years is quite the accomplishment. When did you realize that you wanted to be a journalist, and what steps did you take to make that dream come true?
I think I first got the bug in high school, to be honest with you. I was in the high school newspaper and really had a good experience doing that and knew that I wanted to go into journalism, whether it be print or broadcasting. And then between my junior and senior years of high school, I had the chance to go to a workshop at the University of Missouri, which is where I eventually went to college. It was a workshop for, then we were called minority students, on journalism. And after that two-week workshop, if I had the bug before, it really bit me at that workshop. I knew this was something I wanted to do. So graduated from high school, wound up going to the University of Missouri, and graduated from the School of Journalism, and was very lucky when I graduated. I got a job in Kansas City, at a station in Kansas City, and then just kind of things happened from there. But very early on, I'm one of those people I like to say is very lucky in that I knew what I wanted to do from a pretty young age.
How were you so confident that this was your niche that you wanted to pursue for the rest of your life?
Well, you know, honestly, it's all about it's having a dream, and it's luck. it could have gone in a number of directions. I was just very fortunate in that things kind of worked out for me. I got the job out of college at a TV station, then from Kansas City, then moved to Dallas and moved to St. Louis and CBS and now Cleveland. So things kind of worked out for me that way. There are a million cases where people had that desire. They had the talent, quite frankly, but for whatever reason, it didn't work out. So I remember when I was graduating from college, I guess I was about a month away from graduation. I didn't have a job yet, and a job offer came up in public relations at a defense contractor in St. Louis, a place where my father worked, the McDonnell Douglas, it was called at the time. It doesn't exist anymore. It was bought by Boeing years ago. But I almost took that job, and I often wonder, had I taken that job, what direction my career would have taken. But I didn't, and 2 weeks later, I got the job offer in Kansas City. So it's a question of luck. It's a question of being in the right place at the right time. It's a question of having a dream.
Did you have any positive black role models in the journalism field who you could relate to when you were coming up?
Yeah, and I was of that generation where I was able to watch really the first generation of African-American journalists on television and in print, for that matter. Well, probably in print, it was probably third or fourth generation, but in broadcasting, certainly first generation folks I got to watch. The names you would know would be Ed Bradley and Max Robinson, people like that. There was a local anchor in St. Louis named Julius Hunter, who was a pioneer in that. I believe he was the first black anchor in St. Louis, and I grew up watching him. And I wound up working with him, you know, years later. As I got older, you know, Bryant Gumbel, you know, watching him on television, certainly a role model. Those were all good images, all good people for me to see. Because what that said to me, and what I hope people wanting to go into this business now, you know, will read from folks like me and other folks there, you look at these people and you go, okay, wow, that person can do it, so can I. It's about hard work. It's about tenacity. And trust me, those people had to put up with a lot more mess than I would have had to put up with in my career, simply because they were the first or they were among the first. So that was really nice, watching them on television and getting inspiration from them. And I remember when I was a teenager, I got to actually meet Max Robinson, who to this day is the only African-American to be a regular anchor of a network nightly newscast. That hasn't happened since, and that was the late 70s. You had Bernie Shaw, of course, on CNN, who did a fantastic job. And of the three traditional broadcast networks, there's only been one, and that was Max Robinson. When I was in high school, I was working at a television station as the night switchboard operator, and ABC was just beginning a broadcast called World News Tonight, where they were revamping their nightly newscast. And the anchors toured the country, toured ABC affiliates across the country. And again, as the guy answering the phone at the ABC station in St. Louis, I got to see all these people come in. And when Mr. Robinson came in, I was, you know, quite in awe. And I was 17 years old. But you talk about images and things that stick with you. I've never forgotten that meeting with him, him just being a terrific guy, a very nice guy, an encouraging guy as well. So, yeah, I mean, I had a number of folks that I watched growing up who were quite inspirational to me. I'll tell you the Max Robinson story, but Julius Hunter, the gentleman I was telling you about in St. Louis, this was a guy who just made it look so easy, and it seemed effortless. And as anybody who's been doing anything for a while knows that that's the trick, to make it look effortless. And that's a sign of somebody who's really good. I mean, whether you're a surgeon or a teacher or whatever, if you can make it look really easy, it means that you're doing something right. If you're making it look easy and you're doing a good job, it means that, wow, you've really got it. And this guy had it. And while I got to meet Max in that very brief moment, I later got to work with Julius and see him up close and see how he did things. And it was fabulous. And those kind of things, yes, they give you confidence. They also can be quite humbling, because these folks are very talented. And you wonder, wow, do I don't have, you know, even a scintilla of the talent that they have. But the fact that they were able to persevere, and the fact that they were able to get to where they were, was certainly encouraging to me.
It also sounds that, again, you had this strong desire, because you said you were 17 and you were operating at a lower level position. But that again shows that it's going to take hard work.
Well, there's a funny story behind that as well. When I came back from that workshop I was telling you about, I was quite pumped up and wanted to get a job at a television station in St. Louis, and it was going into my senior year of high school. And I looked at every station in town to see if they had anything, from, you know, the guy who sweeps up to anything at all. And my cousin actually called me up and told me about an opening as the night switchboard operator at this station, at the ABC station in St. Louis. And I went and interviewed and jumped at it. And that was an important year for me, doing that job. And you're right. You're not running the place. You have no sort of control of anything other at that time than answering the telephone. However, for a 17-year-old kid, I got to see the entire station, how it operated. I got to meet some incredible people. It was a wonderful experience. And when I think of the three or four things in my career that were those moments, those turning points, those tent poles, if you will, that is certainly one of them. So don't be disappointed if you, when you walk in the door, you're not sitting in that anchor seat or being the main reporter or being the editor or something like that. That all takes time. And the good part of that is all the experiences you have along the way will help you when you finally do, lucky enough to get to a job like that.
During the beginning of your journalism career, what was the expectation of journalism and journalists, and how has this really changed?
I think, you know, basically it's remained the same in terms of get the story, you know, hopefully get it first, get it right, do it quickly, be proficient, be clear, be a good writer. Those things haven't changed. I think what has changed is be the mechanics of it. Somebody getting out of journalism school now has to do everything. You have to be a good editor, a good writer, a good shooter, a good producer. You have to know how to edit that story. You have to know how to get it on the web. You have to know, you know, how to fix the camera if it doesn't work, all those kind of things. When I was coming to school, we did all those things, but by the time you reach your first or certainly second job, everything was pretty specialized. Whereas my first job in general, you may have been a reporter and a photographer and an editor and all those kind of things. Your second job, you were whatever your training was, whatever that your strength was. So if that was a reporter, you were a reporter. If you were a photographer, you were a photographer. If you were a producer, you were a producer. Now, television stations, even networks, are looking for that person who can do everything. We call them here multimedia journalists, and we have a number on our staff, and they go out and they shoot their own things. They edit their own things. They put them on the air. They put them on the web. That's a skill that when I was coming out of school, you didn't have to have. Well, first of all, there wasn't a web, so that wasn't an issue. But people getting out of school today, entering this business, I say it all the time, have a tougher job, if you will, than people who were getting out in my day, because we were able to specialize, we were able to concentrate on one thing. And in many cases today, that's not the case.
Statistically speaking, according to the National Association for Black Journalists, African Americans account for only 4.65% of journalists in a newsroom. My question to you is, how can these numbers increase?
That's the $64,000 question, and I wish I had an answer for that. I mean, it's something that we've been struggling with certainly throughout my career, especially at the upper management levels where those big decisions are made. I think this business has not been kind to people of color. I call it the most sexist, racist business there is that makes no apologies for it. There are a lot of businesses that are sexist and racist, but at least they apologize for them. This one does not. And I say that, let me just kind of put that in perspective for you. If you're running a television station and you're trying to show diversity in the community, you're going to have X number of people of color. You're not going to have a staff of all people of color, even if the talent pool dictates that. So no one will ever say this to you, but you know, you may get to a market and you'll look at a station and they will not say this to you, but what they're thinking is, well, I already have too many black people. You know, that's not going to work. I'm telling you, that stuff happens. Now, again, nobody's going to say that. Nobody's going to go out in front street with that. And the same with women. Well, I already have too many women, that kind of thing. It's, in that way, incredibly racist, incredibly sexist. There's still a glass ceiling that's pretty low in some places, and it's discouraging to a lot of people. I think what needs to happen, and what has happened for years, is just educating more young folks about this business and encouraging more young folks about this business and telling them what a great business it is, how much fun you can have in it, the adventures that are involved in this business, the fact that you come in every day and you don't know what's going on. You don't know what you're going to do because every day is different. I think getting that word out and just educating folks hopefully will help that a lot. And also, it's a question of staying on top of employers. The National Association of Black Journalists that you mentioned, I mean, does a great job of doing that as far as diversity in hiring and inclusion is concerned, because it's very important. And as I told you earlier, at the upper management level, it is just imperative that we get into those slots because that's where the real decisions are made. And also, I tell youngsters I talk to all the time, and I don't mean to be discouraging. I just mean to be truthful with them. I mean, you don't go in this business to get rich. You know, if you're reading Time magazine and you see that Katie Couric makes $30 million a year, hey, you know what, that's great. But listen, there's only one Katie Couric, okay? Right. That is more the exception than the rule. So if you're going in this business to get rich, you're going in the wrong business. And quite honestly, if anybody who goes in this business for that reason is not only going to be really disappointed from a financial standpoint, they're going to get really frustrated because there is no natural progression of salary in this business. You get out of school, you make X amount. If you're lucky, you get a raise, your next job, and those kind of things. But it's not like working at the GM plant where after being there for 2 years, there's a contracted raise that you have and you go from X to X. It's just not like that. So I would rather have somebody in the business who's passionate, who wants to do this, than somebody who wants to go into this for the money. So I give people the entire spectrum when I talk to them about going into this business, but I would like to see those numbers go up, as we all would. And, you know, I think programs like what you're doing here, getting the word out, and you know, some things that I've been lucky enough to be involved in over the years are helping to do that. So we'll keep our fingers crossed.
Thank you for hitting on that note of the drive and the passion that's needed, because here at Generation Justice, we're always coming from a place of love, but at the same time, approaching media from a place of integrity, transparency, and truth-telling. In your years as a journalist, how has your work like benefited your community?
Yeah, I don't want to be presumptuous enough to say that something I've done has you know, helped the community in that large way. I'd like to think that some stories that I've done have tried to make a difference in their own way. One of my early stories in my career was on street gangs in the city of East St. Louis. And it was a series that we did, and very proud of to this day, and it was almost 30 years ago. But what it did was it forced the Illinois State Police at that time to reevaluate the way they deal with street gangs. And our series was actually a roadmap for future troopers to look at when it came to how they would approach gangs and how they would deal with that problem. I've been able to do a number of stories that dealt with poverty, that deal with the changing economic world in our cities. And I like to think, you know, those kind of stories, you know, make a difference, you know, in their own way. One of the things about coming back to local TV, which has been really rewarding to me, is being a part of a community and making a difference in a really firsthand way. I can go out and I can go to events and I can tell people about things in a very personal way that at the network level I was not able to do. I'm able to do things like last week we had an African American philanthropy summit. You know, I'm able to go to those kind of things and not only learn about how African Americans donate, you know, more to charities per capita than any other ethnic group in this country, and take that message to other groups and say, hey, this is what's going on. Did you know that? I'm able to come to the African American Male Summit where I met you and be a moderator of a panel and hopefully get some good information out there. So it's those kind of things that I think I've been able to do in my career that, you know, hopefully have made a difference in some way. And again, being back in local TV and having that access to people on a one-on-one basis, pretty much, that I really didn't have before, based on the fact that it was a national, I was, you know, doing things on a national level and traveling a lot. But having that now has been really rewarding.
I can't stress the importance of just having that impact on the community, and either your stories that you conducted on gangs to the summits where it's really trying to highlight and motivate African-American males to really strive for greatness. Those are critical assets to the community, so I don't think you have to be too presumptuous with that.
Oh, you're nice. Thank you.
What advice do you have for young journalists of color who are striving to be the next Russ Mitchell or striving to be an editor at a news station or for a magazine or a publication?
Yeah, you know, it's the same advice I would give anybody. Actually, it's have a thick skin. Don't let anyone deter your dreams too much. When I say too much, you're going to hear a lot of things in this, as you move along, that are going to be very discouraging. This is not a business where 2 + 2 = 4 all the time. 2 + 2 = 5 a lot of times. And what I mean by that, it's a very subjective business. Two people can look at something and say, one person can say, that's the greatest thing ever. And the other person can say, oh my God, that's horrible. Okay? So you're going to have people in your career who are going to tell you that's horrible. You're also going to be telling people in your career, if you're lucky, are going to tell you that's really good. Don't let the that's horribles deter you. Have that thick skin. Just keep moving forward. And the other thing is just, you know, be prepared. Just know that things can change at a moment's notice. You can be in Chattanooga one day, and you can get a call to go to Chicago. Know that, especially early in your career, that stuff's probably going to happen. You're going to have your bags packed. You're going to have to be flexible in that way. If you want to move up the ladder, if you want to stay in Chattanooga, that's fine too. But if you want to move up the ladder, you have to be prepared to move. And also, you have to have the passion. We talked about this earlier, but don't go into this business for any other reason other than the fact that you love to tell stories, you love to write, You love to talk to people. Don't do it because you think it's going to make you rich. Don't do it because you think it's going to bring you fame. You do it because you have a passion for this. And if you have that, I'm telling you, that gets you through a lot of humps. We all go home certain days and go, oh, my goodness, you know, boy, why did I do that? Or, boy, I'm terrible at this job. I mean, everybody has those moments. I think what gets us going, what keeps us going, is that passion, that we know that tomorrow is another day and we have another opportunity to do something really great.
Mr. Mitchell, I thank you for the nuggets of knowledge that you've bestowed on us here at Generation Justice.
Listen, no problem at all. Listen, you're a very impressive young man, and I really do appreciate you reaching out and giving me a call. I'm glad this worked out. And listen, best of luck to you, and just stay doing what you're doing. Stay true to yourself, and I know great things are headed for you, and I wish you all the best.
That was our very own Jason Fuller interviewing renowned broadcast journalist Russ Mitchell. Thank you for your honesty about the journalism industry and your advice for aspiring journalists of color.
Mr. Mitchell, your words of wisdom made me more appreciative of the pioneers of color in broadcast journalism.
Before we close, we have a community announcement for you all.
It is with excitement and enthusiasm that we tell you that registration for the 16th Annual Rooted in Community National Summit is now open.
This year's summit will be held in Albuquerque, New Mexico, July 16th through the 20th, and will give us a taste of Southwest culture and foodways, dating back hundreds of thousands of years. As always, the conference will include field trips, youth-led workshops, and a celebration of food, arts, and culture. This year, we will also get a taste of social and food justice in New Mexico, and have the opportunity to learn the history of the struggles that people of color have faced in our state.
Thanks for spending your last hour with us here at Generation Justice, but we gotta go. We want to thank everyone who made the show possible.
Special thanks to Sharon Tenorio and Denise Nava from Big Brothers and Big Sisters of America.
Thank you to my mentor, Mark Worthy, and a special thanks to journalist Russ Mitchell from WKYC-TV.
We would now like to thank Roberta Rael, Melissa Harris, Rashad Mahmoud, and Jason Fuller for producing this show.
And a big thanks to Kamaria Umi for engineering tonight.
A special thanks to Tama Fenderson, Jason Fuller, and Kamaria Umi for editing this show.
We would also like to thank all of our youth media makers here at Generation Justice. Without you all, we will be incomplete.
Stay connected with us. Check out our website, generationjustice.org, where you can listen to all of our past shows, see our music playlists, and watch our videos.
You can also see the music playlist on KUDM.org by searching for Generation Justice. We're also active on social media, so please like us on Facebook by searching for Generation Justice. And follow us on Twitter, @GenJustice.
Tweet, tweet. Generation Justice is funded by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, with additional funding from the McCune Foundation, and of course, all of you who have contributed to our project by visiting our website and clicking Donate.
We are now recruiting for Generation Justice members. Are you interested in multimedia journalism? Do you want to use media to make a difference?
If so, then you should definitely check out Generation Justice. Go on our website, generationjustice.org, and download an application today. You don't want to miss out on this opportunity.
Thank you again for listening. I'm Jason Fuller.
And I'm Lucia Martinez. We'll close with a few songs.
Up next is Spoken Word.
See you all next week.
Deuces.
Somos muchos y también somos pocos. Somos el golpe cuando aterriza y también somos la piel cuando cicatriza. La muerte nunca nos venció porque todo lo que muere es porque alguna vez nació.